Murder in the Rain, where each week Emily Rowney, Alicia Holland, and Josh McCullough tell true crime stories of the Pacific Northwest. Murder in the Rain contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to another edition of Crime and Updates, where we'll talk about what's in the news, update some of our previous cases, and entertain you with our buffoonery. But first, let's give some love to our latest $10 tier patrons. Welcome Meg M. from Myrtle Creek, Oregon, home of two historic covered bridges that span the titular creek. And a big hello up the hill to our other newest member, Shamra Z. from Oregon City, Oregon, home of the Oregon City Municipal Elevator. Speaking of Patreon, you can become a member and enjoy ad-free episodes at our $1 tier. At the next level, along with ad-free episodes, you have access to all of our wonderful content, like cases from our patrons' hometowns, and Deduce, which is a riff on the 90s TV series Beyond Belief, Fact or Fiction, in which Alicia tries to stump Emily and I with tales both true and false, and Shoop in the Poop, which are compilations of off-topic conversations we have during recordings. We don't shoot the shit, we shoot the poop. All of that and more for you, it's true, on Patreon. Please, help me feed my hungry dog.
So let's start with Sean Diddy Combs, a.k.a. P. Diddy, Diddy, Puff Daddy, Puff Love, Brother Love, Puffy Love. Did I miss any? Now, most people, especially millennials, probably either loved or hated him over the years, but I think everyone was enthralled watching the latest news about him. On March 25th, Video Everywhere was featuring Sean Combs' homes in Los Angeles and Miami because they were being raided by Homeland Security. Now, this was part of a large investigation, one that I've had my eye on because it's very messy. So currently, there's a pretty big list of civil lawsuits against Diddy, and they go back many years. Let's get into the more dirty bits of Sean Combs. Here's a timeline of sorts. A November 2023 lawsuit outlines that Sean Combs and singer Aaron Hall allegedly sexually assaulted an unnamed victim after an event. She was then severely beaten several days later. This would have been in 1990 or 1991. In that same lawsuit, claims were made that in 1991, Sean Combs drugged and sexually assaulted 19-year-old Joy Dickerson after she went on a date with him. The assault was allegedly videotaped. In 1996, Sean Combs was found guilty of criminal mischief for threatening a New York Post photographer, and it doesn't seem too crazy except for the fact that he did it with a gun. Later that same year in April, he was arrested and charged with second-degree assault and criminal mischief, both felonies, for the beating of record executive Steve Stewie. Apparently, Combs, with the help of two of his bodyguards, used their fists, a telephone, and a champagne bottle and a chair to beat him. Sean Combs then publicly apologized and paid about $500,000, and the charges were dropped to harassment, and Combs got sentenced to a single day of anger management classes. In 1999, Combs and his girlfriend du jour of the time, J-Lo, were arrested in a club in New York because of a shooting. He was charged with a weapons violation, but was later acquitted. In March 2001, a TV host named Roger Mills sued Combs, saying that he was imprisoned, assaulted, and beat up by Sean Combs and his friends. They also apparently destroyed some of his equipment. They went to court in 2004, and the jury felt that it was a ruse by the TV host to get attention. So charges were dropped, or it went in the favor of Sean Combs.
I forgot about the J-Lo one. That was when she was in her bandana era.
In 2003, there was a lawsuit that mentioned Combs and two friends gang-raped a 17-year-old victim in their Manhattan recording studio. In 2023, another unnamed person came forward to accuse Combs of gang-raping her in 2003. In February of 2006, Cassie Ventura, a singer that Combs signed at 19 years old, alleged that she suffered years of physical, psychological, and emotional abuse at the hands of Combs. She went on to say that he forced her to buy illegal drugs and use them. He also forced her to participate in sex with paid male sex workers, which he would then watch and film. In a March 2007 lawsuit, a man named Gerard Richnitzer claimed that Sean Combs punched him and punched his girlfriend at a nightclub in Hollywood. The case was settled outside of court. In May of 2007, Laura Ann Gibson, one of the castmates of Combs' show Making the Band, filed a complaint with the police, noting that Combs threatened her life with a chair. What's with him and the chairs?
He came up in the 90s. They were very popular.
Chair-driven
wrestling,
violence.
Springer.
Oh, good point. Wrestling. In the same November 2023 suit I mentioned earlier, Cassie Ventura mentioned that in 2010, Sean Combs began to systematically own her. And this was done over a long period of time, but at one point he requested her medical records and then took over coordinating all of her medical care. Now, why was she having medical care? Well, she was experiencing ongoing issues with her memory due to head injuries from getting beaten by him and the forced drug use. She also stated that in February of 2012, Combs told her that he was going to, quote, blow up the car of rapper Kid Cudi, the person she happened to be dating at the time. In 2018, Cassie Ventura claims that she met with Combs to have dinner and discuss a Bad Boy Records contract, but it ended up with him forcing himself into her apartment and raping her. She then tried to take steps to completely remove herself from him. And that was like, stop using your car because he bought the car, move out of your apartment because he paid for the apartment.
Right.
I mean, anything he got her, she tried to stop using and cut herself off. In the latest lawsuit from February 2024, producer Rodney Little Rod Jones claimed that while he worked with Diddy from 2022 to 2023, he was sexually assaulted, including being forced by Sean Combs to engage in sexual acts and to solicit sex workers, and that he was even drugged and repeatedly groped in his anus and genitals by Combs. So this is an ongoing theme. And there are more instances that I didn't even outline here, but I think it gives you a little flavor for what we're dealing with. So now we know there are claims of forcing people to take drugs and participate in sex with sex workers. There's groping, rape allegations. And now we know that the investigation where they entered the house is due to claims that Combs violated human trafficking laws. Now, of course, he made a statement and it said, quote, "Let me be absolutely clear. I did not do any of the awful things being alleged. I will fight for my name, my family, and for the truth." So far, there's only been a single arrest, and that was a 25-year-old associate of his named Brennan Paul, who happened to have cocaine on him at the airport. So, things are going to happen. We're going to learn things. There probably will be an arrest. But, what are your thoughts?
I've never liked him.
Yeah, there's something about him.
From day one, I saw him in a Biggie video, and I was like, well, who is this hanger-on? What's going on here? Then I learned he was the producer. And I was like, oh, OK, that's awfully close for a producer. But, at the time you had Timberland doing videos with Aaliyah and it was kind of that kind of relationship back in the day. But I just was like, what is going on here? And then when he came out with the "We'll Be Missing You" and after Biggie had died, I was like,
boy, had that planned.
I'll bet it was a little kind of too. Why is that what you're doing for your... No one did that for Tupac. Why is that your go-to? And then who owns Biggie's masters? And if he seemed to be like the business guy. So I was just kind of like, what clause do you have in who and what? That was always my initial feeling. Then I hated how much he sampled. I'm like, he cannot rap. He cannot dance. And all he does is sample. So what's the deal?
He hid behind the talent of Mace, obviously.
Clearly.
Why are you over there looking at me? Why my girl standing here?
And then when he started dating Cassie, she's much younger than
him. Yeah, and more attractive, too.
It's kind of like Harvey Weinstein, like these whispered secrets that aren't exactly
secrets.
And
a lot of the stuff, there's evidence surfacing, like with the whole gunshot thing there. I think there was some video of a back room with blood. So they're pretty sure he was involved. And
I did see something. I don't know how legit this is, but basically in part of the raid was that they found cameras everywhere.
Because he was videotape, he would use sex workers and he would force people to have sex with them and videotape it, allegedly.
Well, and also allegedly was that he would have these huge parties and people were kind of saying like they were basically sex parties and everyone was doing everybody. But then that now, I guess I'll say I wouldn't be surprised if it came out that he had some sort of blackmail situation going on. You know, I've got this big name celebrity in my bathroom doing cocaine or something. Like,
there's a lot of videos surfacing of him being inappropriate with Justin Bieber when he was underage and how he treated him. And with the way Justin Bieber's career has gone, and there are a lot of allegations against other people about how they treated him. So it will be.
And let's not forget his very healthy 40 something year old wife that fell over dead. So it'll be nice to see if there are, if there is evidence and facts and proof of things that he did that were.
Well, there are. In order to get to a raid in your two of your homes and you're this big shot person, like, they have proof.
But that's what I'm saying. Once that comes out, you know, if R. Kelly can spend the rest of his life in prison, anyone can.
If you recall, in November of 2022, we aired the episode titled Unprecedented. In that episode, I discussed the case of a man named Richard Gilmore, who was eventually known as the Portland Jogger Rapist. This guy terrorized Portland and the surrounding areas in the 1970s and 1980s. His method was to jog around neighborhoods in East Portland to try to find potential victims. He would then learn their habits by watching their house for days. When he saw an opportunity to strike, he would take it, breaking into the homes when a young girl was alone. He would hide his face, attack her, and then slip back into the night. Eventually, he would be caught after an epic search, years after he started his reign of terror. He admitted to 9 victims, but because of Oregon's statute of limitations, he was only tried for one of those rapes, the rape of a 13-year-old girl named Tiffany Edens. During the trial, Tiffany was a crucial witness, but other survivors were allowed to speak at the trial, including one of his earlier victims, Danielle Tudor. I had the absolute honor of speaking with Tiffany and Danielle to hear them tell their stories and talk about why it was so important everyone heard them. Richard Gilmore got out of prison on parole the following December, a month after our episode aired. And due to the fact that he was only convicted of his crimes against Tiffany, paired with other factors such as his age, victimology, and his record in prison, he was only granted a level 1 sex offender status. During that episode, we dove into why that was abhorrent and what that meant for the community. I highly suggest listening to that episode, Unprecedented, if you haven't already. Heck, listen to it again if you've already heard it. It's very powerful to hear these women's stories and to really grasp the gravity of what it means when a dangerous person gets out on parole and dig into the intricacies of how parole works. We talked a lot about that in that episode. Since that episode aired, we've continued to talk and work with Tiffany and Danielle. We love hearing about their work in victims' advocacy and pairing together when we can. Around the time that Gilmore was out on parole, Alicia worked with Tiffany to create flyers and alert the neighborhood he was moving into. She and Tiffany spent the afternoon putting them all over Portland. And you also went to a protest, right?
I did, yeah. So initially, and I think we talked about this back when it happened, but when he was paroled, they provided a photo from the prison that was grainy and blurry, and you almost couldn't even make out his features. So I took that photo and had someone do their best to make it look like a person to get as much detail as we could, because that you would think, well, I guess you wouldn't think by now that they would provide an accurate photo to warn people that this person is.
But they don't, because at level 1, they don't have to.
So we upgraded the photo. We made some flyers. We went out and the news came out and interviewed Tiffany. And we went all through Chinatown. My mom joined me, and we actually went up kind of throughout downtown Portland because he was housed in Chinatown or Old Town. And so we went all around that area, even up to 23rd, because there are some schools up in that area. And we left some of the flyers with school administration to just say, FYI, this is happening. And not only to warn them, but also hopefully to piss some people off and go, wait, what?
Why weren't we told?
Yeah, did the flyers. And then I cannot remember the date, but it wasn't long after that that they held a protest.
It was like a month,
Salem.
I think.
Yeah, it was not that long after he was released. And just in front of the Capitol, we don't even know who all was there. They were doing construction on the building, so we didn't even know if people were in session, if the governor was there, if anyone was present. But Tiffany, and she's got a huge family, really, at this point, of people that she has helped through recovery and through, you know, being victims of things and support. And so they all showed up, and it was just signs reminding not just Salem, but the legislators and the lawmakers and all of those people to say, Maybe it's too late now because he's out, but something can still be done to let people know, to maybe change his status, to not do this in the future. So not sure what all has come from that, but I know they've still been working tirelessly to get laws passed around the country and doing really great work. It's been, like you said, it's been a real honor to be brought into their group of their people to help how we can.
Mm-hmm. And last summer, when we went to the True Crime and Paranormal Podcast Festival in Austin, Texas, we actually shared their case in a live session. It was kind of like a panel. We were partnered with another podcast and we talked about the cases and then answered questions from the crowd. Danielle actually came to the festival to visit us and answered questions people had in the audience. So one gal had asked, you know, I am a victim too, and I want to get laws changed. How do you get into that? And Danielle was super patient and talked to people and answered the questions. And it was just a really cool way to kind of extend the community even farther.
Yeah, it was really great. And now they're doing more of that and they're doing more engagements and getting more comfortable talking to people to share their story even more, which has been really cool to watch.
Next week, we'll actually be airing a special episode. We were lucky enough to sit back down with them in person this time in Oregon with Danielle Tudor and Tiffany Edens. And we thought you might like to hear that conversation, which will give you a sneak peek at some of the stories that will be included in their upcoming book. And this is about their lives. So it will touch on the case, but it also digs into much more of their history. Tiffany talks about her recovery and what it was like deep in her drug use. And it's eyebrow raising, but I think it will be a fascinating book. So I'm really excited about that.
Yeah. And they have an incredible sense of humor about all of it.
Sure.
And they can really, it's been so cool to watch just in the couple of years that we've known them to the degree we've known them, to watch their relationship flourish and to watch them kind of go, oh, wait, all this noise behind us, let's move forward together. And the way they're able to kind of laugh, and it's really almost sisterly. It's like you have the big sister, Danielle.
Well, and they call each other sis.
Yeah. And she's like very composed, very organized. I don't know how type A she is, but I would say she's
pretty
more
type A.
Yeah. And then you have Tiffany, who I believe, not to give you a teaser for the show, but I believe she started our conversation of, well, this one time when I was putting meth up my butt, and we're like, this is going to be a great night. So they're just so candid in the fact that they're willing to just share all of who they are with everyone to say, this can happen to anyone you love, and here are all of the consequences and ramifications from all of that, and here's what you can do if you are a victim and a survivor.
Yeah.
It's really been awesome to be part of.
They also dive into their relationship and how it's changed from, you know, one-time victims to survivors, now to victims advocates working together as business partners. So they'll share a little bit about their animosity that they used to have towards each other for different reasons, but how that actually blossomed into a sisterhood. So I think you'll enjoy it. Also, Alicia, aren't they going to be at True Crime Fest Northwest?
Yes, they actually will be. So I'm going to transition right into True Crime Fest Northwest. We have got some new vendors and presenters that we can announce. And again, True Crime Fest Northwest is going to be this Labor Day weekend at the Portland Airport Sheraton. We have worked with Rebecca Morris on a very early episode where we interviewed her about her book, Ted and Anne, and she will be presenting. And I'm really excited to see what story she decides to cover, because she wrote Ted and Anne, which was about Ted Bundy when he was younger and living in Washington.
I also interviewed her about another story of a guy from my hometown she went to high school
That's
with.
That's right.
Yeah.
I forgot.
We've done two interviews with her.
And she's amazing. I just really adore her. She also wrote If I Can't Have You, the story of Susan Powell. And she also worked with Desiree Young to write Boy Missing, which is about the Kyron Horman story. So I know that whatever she decides to present, it's going to be fantastically interesting. So
oh, yeah.
I cannot wait to see her presentation. Also appearing at a table and giving a presentation will be the United Justice Group. These are family members and loved ones who lost someone to the alleged serial killer of Portland over the last couple of years. The victims include Kristen Smith, Joanna Speaks, Charity Perry, Ashley Real, and Bridget Webster. We don't know yet exactly what the group will be talking about, because we do know there is some news that's possibly going to be coming out soon. We just know that they're wanting to gather information and also share accurate information. I know that that's something they're really looking forward to. You're going to hear it from the horse's mouth.
This isn't
through Instagram. This isn't through the news. This is from them.
That will be really good, because we get a lot of questions about that case.
Yeah.
And there isn't a whole lot known, because it's
active.
It's active, and yeah. Nobody wants to ruin the case.
Yeah. they've had some interesting experiences, especially with the detectives and what they've found out and what can and can't be said. I've talked to several of them at length, and they're amazing people. So I'm really excited for them to have that stage and tell their story. We also have Lindsay Wade, who was from Emily's episode Mud and Blood. She'll be appearing, and you might recall that she's the retired detective from Seattle PD who did some legit detective work to solve a decades-old cold case with DNA. Like Emily said, Danielle and Tiffany will be giving a presentation about their history and advocacy, and hopefully they'll have some news about their upcoming book. And Finley Creek Jane Doe, that is a group that's been working for years to identify a woman whose remains were found in 1978 in Elgin, Oregon. Other vendors include Missing in the PNW podcast, Offbeat Olives, ourselves, of course, and more to come. Fingers crossed that by our next update, we will be able to share some really exciting news about an additional speaker. To stay up to date on the speakers and vendors and all the exciting news around it, you can follow True Crime Fest Northwest on Insta. That's True Crime Fest NW. Be sure to get your tickets now at True Crime Fest Northwest. That's all spelled out like Northwest, NORTHWEST.com. There is still some room for vendors as well. So if you are an ethical creator in the true crime world and you're in the Northwest, go check it out. Get yourself a table. And we hope to see you there. True Crime Fest Northwest.com this Labor Day weekend, Portland Airport Sheraton.
And you'll get to see my new boobs.
Oh man, I wish my new boobs would be there.
Prior to us starting these update episodes, I had an update that I forgot to tell you about. I'm really sorry. So now before I get to that update, let's revisit the episode because it has been quite some time ago. This is episode 13, Help Me, which aired June of 2020. And I told you about Amanda Jo Stotsmith, a young mother who threw her two children off of the Selwood Bridge here in Portland, Oregon. Amanda had struggles with drugs and alcohol, was potentially dealing with abuse at home, and had a traumatic past due to one of her boyfriends taking his own life and clearly some mental health issues. During a scheduled visitation where she had the opportunity to spend the 4th of July with her two youngest children, she had three total, she took the two youngest children out to see fireworks, she made the decision to drop her sleeping children 90 feet into the Willamette River. Locals heard the screams of her 7-year-old daughter, Trinity, and called police. Rescue boats were able to pull Trinity from the waters alive, but unfortunately, her 4-year-old son, Eldon, drowned to death after the fall. After a brief stint fleeing from police, Amanda was apprehended and eventually sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 35 years. Since she entered prison, she was very quiet, refused to talk to the media, and we never really learned much about her life in prison or like the level of remorse she had. I assume she had it once she was getting treatment in prison, but we never got to hear about it. Even the woman that wrote her book tried incredibly hard to talk to her and get her to like make a statement about it, and she never wanted to. So this is one of the old episodes we have taken down from some platforms. You can hear it on YouTube, and if you're a Patreon member, you can still have access to it there as well. So go listen to it if you can handle it. It is a sensitive topic. Some people don't like cases about children. Now for the update. On June 4th, 2023, this past summer, Amanda Jo Stotsmith was found dead in her jail at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility in Wilsonville. Her cause of death wasn't shared publicly, and in a blog post written by author Nancy Rommelman, the same author that wrote the book on Amanda's case, To the Bridge, she mentioned that we may never know the cause. She has a friend who is a former DA, and that friend mentioned that the Oregon Department of Corrections has, quote, developed a policy of refusing to say anything about inmates' deaths. And I do know that to be pretty common. There are times where they don't say a peep. So I don't know if she took her own life. I mean, I think she was 44 or something.
So we have people that are in custody, and if they die, they aren't required to say what happened?
Apparently, and I think that's bonkers. So I guess, I mean, the family probably is told. So if they come forward with the information, maybe
of
we can learn
people,
it.
Their stuff should be accessible at least by the public.
I agree. I think
if they were beaten, was
exactly.
It someone else?
Did someone take her life? Did she take her own life?
Was it natural? An
officer? And you guys, there have been a lot of rumblings about the treatment of female inmates at that location and at a couple of others. And I think I have a case. I touched on it people have said they've been sexually assaulted, or there's a lot of like buying them off with drugs and things. So
that is wild.
I feel bad for her children. We don't know if they were working on connecting with her, or especially the oldest one, Gavin, who had a strong connection with her. And then he was so upset he didn't go with them on July 4th. And I'm sure he feels guilt about that. Him and his sister were forced apart for a while. Her dad wouldn't let her see him. So I'm sure it's hard. And then, you know, having Amanda in common, I'm guessing it's taken a toll on the kids. And so I feel sorry for them if they didn't get to say what they wanted to say or hear what they needed to hear from her.
Wow. That's a lot of weird stuff, I think.
I'm sorry I didn't double check that, but I think she's 44. So I don't think it's natural.
And it was a well-known case. I mean, not the most well-known, well, but
when
a
you
big deal
are
up
a
here.
Child killer, that puts a target on your back.
Wow.
I don't
that's
know.
Weird.
Yeah.
And that's also a weird law or rule or whatever.
So
that I'm
if
not a
you
fan of.
Are close with someone in Coffee Creek,
or if you work in an Oregon prison and you know the rules,
why like, they don't tell.
Yeah. Like we asked for people that had been on jury duty to write us, and we got one, and we need to share his story. But we would love to hear if you work in a prison system or understand this rule, why that would be in place, because that sounds shady. Here at Murder in the Rain, we love a good family mystery and we love a good video game. And now that we have the convenience of holding computers in our hands, we know the absolute joy of finding the perfect video game. Just like most of us, I like to wind down at night with some gameplay on my phone, usually while waiting for ads to finish on my streamer service, and June's Journey is a perfect match. Step into the 1920s in the role of June Parker, who is searching for hidden clues to uncover the mystery of her sister's murder. You can use your keen observation skills to quickly uncover key pieces of information that lead to each chapter of the game. And of course, there's a scandalous hidden family secret to uncover. It has it all. Mystery, danger, romance. Where will each new chapter take you? Now, this isn't any old mystery game. You get to customize your very own estate island by decorating and building gardens and buildings. You can even chat and play with or against other players by joining a detective club.
I'm pretty early into the game, but there is already so much to enjoy. The setting of the 1920s is fun and really beautifully done. The mystery is exciting, like when a character fell through a secret trap door. I like playing a game to relax, but to also stimulate my mind. It's not a difficult game, but you have to be paying attention and moving fast to find objects in time to multiply your score. June's Journey also features puzzling elements, like a torn-up photograph that I had to reassemble. It's cool!
Can you crack the case? Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. The styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then, when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new-to-you styles. Like many of you, my personal style has evolved over the years. But if I want to try something new, sometimes it's hard to know what pieces will work for me. Rather than going to the mall for hours and spending too much money on pieces I might not like, Armoire allows me to rent high-quality designer clothing for any occasion. I can try styles I never considered before without worrying about the store's return policy. Of course, all of this sounds great, but what's even better is that it's a woman-founded business. You benefit from finding the perfect outfits, all while supporting a business that was built by women just like us.
Right now, our listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off of their first month. That's up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/murderintherain. That's armoire.style/murderintherain, one word, to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today. With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom or the motherly figure in your life? Let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Pretty cool, right? Here's how it works. Every week, mylifeinabook.com will send your recipient a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about, for example, your mom's life or any custom questions that you want to ask. And then she can either type her response or record her voice. And mylifeinabook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and her stories forever. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy, something you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. Obviously, we love anything surrounding storytelling. It's what we do. So to be able to gift this to my mom, to not only hear her stories, but the stories of my grandparents and other family members, it will create a cherished gift for all of us to enjoy. Check out mylifeinabook.com and use the code RAIN at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's mylifeinabook.com and use the code RAIN for 10% off today. In my episode Trunks, one of the stories I shared was that of Sarah Zagul. Here is the background on her case before we get to the update. Sarah Zagul was a stunning Jordanian-American woman who lived in Aloha, Oregon with her large, close family. At only 28 years old, she had lived a lot of life. She was a mother to 8-year-old Tariq. She was a model and actress, and at one point she had been a drug dealer. And in January of 2018, she was ready to get help for her addictions. It was that decision, the one to get better, that would ironically lead to her demise. Sarah's mother, Chris Ann, dropped her off to seek inpatient treatment at Providence St. Vincent Medical Center. Unfortunately, the hospital didn't have room for her that night, so Sarah called her mom, who then picked her up and took her to a hotel in Beaverton in hopes of being able to enroll in treatment the following day. Sadly, her being alone in that hotel room anxiously awaiting what rehab would bring, Sarah was struggling with her addiction, and she reached out to a dealer she knew. New is a little bit too casual for their relationship. Not only had 37-year-old Jeremiah Johnston been Sarah's dealer, she had worked for him as a seller at one point. Once contacted, Jeremiah picked Sarah up from the hotel room and took her back to Aloha, to his parents' home, a home that was only half a mile from the house she shared with her parents. Settled into his home, Jeremiah confronted Sarah about the money he claimed she owed him from her dealing days. There's no way of knowing what her response to his demand was, but she made it clear to Jeremiah he would not be getting any money from her. This sent Jeremiah into a rage. Unsure of what to do with Sarah to get what he wanted, he duct taped her to a chair, but quickly let her go. Seeing that as an opportunity to escape, Sarah made a run for it. Before she could get out of the house, Jeremiah caught up with her and threw her down a flight of stairs. In doing so, she hit her head on the wall so hard that she began to throw up. Dazed and possibly concussed, she asked if she could take a shower to clean the vomit off, which he allowed. It was then, as she was showering, that Jeremiah decided what he would have to do with the woman that owed him a little bit of money. He was going to kill her. As she bathed, he went downstairs and got a kitchen knife. Leading Sarah to the basement in his parents' home, once she was out of the bathroom, he tied her hands, laid her down, climbed on top of her, and slit her throat with the knife. Waiting the several minutes it takes for someone to bleed to death, he then decided what to do next. Go to bed. The following day, he decided to dismember Sarah. He put most of her body into black garbage bags, everything except her head. For that, he grabbed the large teddy bear he had already purchased. Removing the stuffing from the bear's head, he took Sarah's head, which he had wrapped and taped into a black bag, and placed it into the bear's. Eventually, Sarah's mom tried to get a hold of her via text. Jeremiah responded, posing as Sarah. He texted the mother of the woman he had cut into pieces, something along the lines of, "I've decided not to go to rehab, and instead I'm taking a trip. Don't worry about me." After cleaning his mess, he took Sarah's remains and the bear to his BMW and left them in the trunk before moving the car away from his parents' house. For 5 days, Sarah's whereabouts were unknown as she lay in his trunk. After almost a week, Jeremiah finally reached out to a friend, not to confess, but to ask for help in disposing of the body. 36-year-old Jeremy Mooney received a call from his friend saying that not only had he killed someone, but he needed his assistance. He told his friend, "I killed a drug addict. No one will miss her. Luckily, Jeremy wasn't as horrible a person as his friend. He not only refused to help hide the body, he called the police. They searched the area and found the car. Except that since they had no evidence or warrants, there was nothing they could really do but wait. Jeremiah then took the car and went to a nearby grocery store. The police followed, and once the car was left in the parking lot, they brought in cadaver dogs who hit on the trunk. Because of the dogs, they were able to get a search warrant. They opened the trunk and found Sarah's remains. Well, most of her remains. The head, which had been put in the bear, was no longer with the rest of her body. While detectives processed the car and body, other officers searched the nearby woods for Jeremiah. They were eventually able to locate him, except now he had cuts to his throat and wrists from where he had attempted to take his life with the knife he had just purchased at the store. Jeremiah was arrested and put in jail. Having not learned his lesson from his friend tattling on him, he immediately solicited a fellow inmate to kill Jeremy, the friend who had called the police. Luckily, that inmate was on the same moral high ground as Jeremy and also tattled. You know I love a good tattle. This not only protected Jeremy the snitch, but allowed for prosecution to build an even stronger case, because you probably wouldn't hire someone to kill your friend if you weren't guilty. Finally, after a plea deal was made, Jeremiah had his day in court on the 5th of December, 2019. There, in a courtroom filled with Sarah's friends and family, Jeremiah Johnston pled guilty to first-degree murder, second-degree kidnapping, first-degree abuse of a corpse, and conspiracy to commit first-degree murder of a witness. Being that it was a plea deal, there were caveats to his life sentence. One is that he can become eligible for parole in 2084. So while it is likely he will die behind bars before those 65 years are up, there were two questions the family wanted answered that unfortunately were not part of the deal. Most importantly, Sarah's head. While Jeremiah admitted in court to everything he had done in murdering and dismembering Sarah, he failed to disclose where he ended up putting her head after placing it in the teddy bear but removing it from the vehicle. The other question they wanted answered, the new security code for her phone. When Sarah was at his house, Jeremiah found her phone and used it to text her mom. After he did so, he changed the access code. Her family was desperately hoping he would spare them the continued pain of not allowing her body to rest in peace and to keep them from accessing all of her photos and videos. But they would not get those answers, at least not at that time. As the prosecution begged for him to provide closure to Sarah's family, Jeremiah sat emotionless and silent. Hearing the echoes of the courtroom, which held no supporters of his own, Sarah's sister reminded Jeremiah of their family's Muslim beliefs while she read from the Quran at his sentencing, saying, quote, "Whoever kills a believer intentionally, his punishment is hell." Sarah's parents are now raising her son. Sarah was known by friends as a loving, fun, caring friend, sister, daughter, and mother, the kind of person that would give you anything you needed. And as her family member told Oregon Live after the sentencing, Sarah will continue to live on within our heavy hearts and minds. She will walk beside us in every step we take. Her light will not be dimmed by the dark shadows of these events. Her smiles and laughter will not be forgotten in the silence of the nights ahead. Poignantly, as Jeremiah was taken from the courtroom, a lone voice shouted, "Coward." Now for the update. Thanks to a listener who wrote me on Instagram, and I'm so sorry that I cannot find your name in the sea of messages, but thank you, and thank you for the conversation we had. And thank you for informing me of the update that came through not long after that episode originally aired. Jeremiah did not provide the family with the new code to her phone, but authorities were informed of the location of Sarah's head. At first, it was unclear how the location was provided, but eventually it came out that Jeremiah had given that information. The information he gave to officers led to a wetland area north of Highway 26. It was also learned that before Jeremiah went to court, he had told an inmate he was keeping the head's location a secret as a, quote, bargaining chip. The reason behind the change of heart is what it usually is. He didn't want to move prisons. To keep from ending up at the Snake River Correctional Institute on the Idaho border, he decided to make a deal. In exchange for telling the location of Sarah's remains, he could stay at the Oregon State Correctional Institution in Salem. A bonus is that officials weren't really concerned with where he ended up, which kind of makes me wonder if they came up with that move, which would put him 6 or so hours away from his family, in hopes that he would use said bargaining chip sooner than expected and at least give the family that answer. That was kind of the feel I got.
Yeah.
That they're like, why don't we just tell him we're going to move him and see what he does? So now Sarah can rest in peace. Hopefully this discovery brought her family even the smallest bit of closure or something like it. Obviously, this doesn't bring her back, but at least they don't have to wonder about that aspect. Jeremiah Johnston will be eligible for parole in 62 years.
Now about that passcode.
Maybe in a year or two, they'll pull it again and be like, oh, we're moving you to some other faraway location and have him panic.
They have been moving people a lot in recent years, so.
I wish they would just make a deal at the front and say, "What? Okay, fine. Who cares what prison you want to be in if you're at least in prison? Let's make a deal saying you will stay at the Salem location for the rest of your life, but you have to give us these two answers."
And by now, he might have forgotten it. That's the thing that gets me.
It's like this him-hawing back and forth and, oh, we'll do this for a deal and we'll say we're going to move you and blah, blah, blah. Just do it at the top. Get it over with. Ugh, it's terrible. I know the technology for password stuff is very protected and intense.
I just don't understand why phone companies, when somebody dies, doesn't just give that information to the same person that would get your money.
Yeah.
You know, I'm guessing they're protecting privacy.
Yeah.
Because I probably have very questionable things on there. I don't need my mother seeing.
Yeah, there's a lot of law rigmarole around it. But yeah, in this instance, you would think that they could find something that would
let them have the photos and videos.
Yeah. Another update comes from my episode, Cosmic Coincidence. Barbara Tucker was a sophomore at Mount Hood Community College in 1980, having graduated 2 years earlier from Cleveland High School, where she excelled at basketball. Interested in pursuing a business degree, she started her career-focused education in high school, volunteering with the Distributive Education Club of America, aka DECA. For those who loved Barbara, it wasn't surprising the free-spirited, strong-willed, hardworking teen was focused on learning and growing. At 5'11", it was a bit ironic she was known as the baby of the family, the youngest of seven children to parents Albert and Louise. Barbara got a rental living just across the street from the college at the East Wind Apartments and was taking business classes in the evening. January 15, 1980 was a crisp, cold day. Barbara had called her mother to update her on how she was doing and her plans for the day ahead. Hoping her class might get out early, Barbara told her mother if it wasn't too late by the time she was done, she would go to a friend's apartment for ice cream. Walking to class on one of the many tree-covered footpaths, Barbara encountered someone who unexpectedly struck her in the head with a blunt object. A violent attack ensued, but Barbara was tenacious and she was able to wrench herself away from the man. Crashing through the bushes, she emerged onto Kane and 257th Drive. With blood and splashes of mud on her face and clothing, Barbara tried flagging down cars, frantically waving at passing traffic. Witnesses would later tell police that they did see the young woman, and being at a college campus, they thought her actions, crawling into the street to the point that cars had to swerve to avoid hitting her, with one even coming very close to doing so, were all just part of a college prank. Not one of those witnesses stopped to make sure that they were witnessing a joke. No one asked Barbara if her cries for help were real or not. Even when witnesses reported they saw a young white male come out of the same wooded area, grab Barbara by her arms, and drag her back into the woods, they still did not check on her. They did not call for help or do anything. Barbara's attacker, the man who pulled her back, raped her before killing her with a series of catastrophic blows to the head. She had done everything she could to save herself, but no one did what they could to help. The next morning, a student walking to class discovered Barbara's partially dressed body in some bushes. Investigators noted drag marks in the dirt and three large pools of type O blood, which was the same as Barbara's. Soon after the murder, police were able to release a sketch of the suspect based on witness accounts. There wasn't much to be gleaned from it, a clean-shaven young white man wearing a ski cap and jacket. That sketch and all witnesses led to nothing. Due to the sexual assault, there was DNA evidence that was saved, but it was of no use as the technology to test it had not yet been developed. Out of desperation, police asked one of those witnesses to speak to a hypnotist. After they did so, officials felt they had a better, more detailed description of the killer. The witness believed the suspect was in his early 20s and had dark eyebrows, brown hair, high cheekbones, and an olive complexion.
You know, sorry to cut in here, but I find the use of a hypnotist to be something in the past I might have criticized, but I wonder if what it really does is stop you from questioning yourself, because when you're asked to describe someone, I don't know about you, but I get stressed out about accuracy.
Oh, hello. I can't speak or write or have memory for anything.
Right. Like, so I'm wondering if it's wading through the overthinking nature of the human brain to just get the bare minimum information you took in visually.
I don't know. I feel like it would be your subconscious. So it's like, is this a dream? Is this someone you saw in a TV show?
And I know we've seen scientific studies that show that our memories aren't as good as we think they are.
Right.
But what a wild turn of events in that case.
That's so 80s, too. Send them to a hypnotist, then a psychic. That's why if I ever see anything fishy, that just gave me a tingle, but it's not worth pulling over or calling the police. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I always try to just take two or three things. Be like, okay, I saw a red baseball hat and a blue Nissan.
And I
think be like, that's what I know for sure.
And after watching the things we watch and listening to the things we listen to, I definitely categorize a little bit better as an adult. But if I'm driving down the road and I see that, I don't know what I would recall.
Yeah.
I would like to think I would have stopped. And I can't, but I can empathize with the people that witnessed it thinking it was a prank. People do dumb shit on college campuses, you know?
Yeah. And they do have to live with that forever. So
Absolutely.
Kind of had a natural
repercussion.
But I think that for me is what made this story stick. I mean, I think that was 2 years ago we covered it.
She could have been saved.
Yeah, she got away and crawled into the street.
A
very busy street. It was less busy than there wasn't like the movie theater and Jack in the Box, but it was a busy, it's a main road. And all the college kids are around there. And just to imagine seeing this person walk out and grab her by the arms. Mm.
It also makes me rethink all the time I spent in that parking lot right there. There are little paths everywhere. You have to take one of the paths to get to the little observation area for the astronomy class. Like, I was always over there walking by myself at night, had no idea that happened
in
the 80s.
And it's Oregon. Thick trees everywhere.
Oh, yeah. It's right in the middle of a little forest area.
It still looks like that, too.
Yeah.
It doesn't look any different.
Wow.
There's a lot of bushes to hide in.
Seriously, you guys going to college there, knowing now what we know?
It's
very scary.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I was there all the time late at night because we would have our concerts and we would throw festivals, theater shows,
rehearsals.
I would be out there by myself. Many times I locked my keys in my car and I'd just be waiting for the tow truck driver in that same area.
Yeah.
He would make fun of me because I, thank God, had AAA because I wouldn't have been able to afford my lifestyle with how many times he had to unlock that car for me. Honestly.
The witness said that the man was about 6 feet tall with a stocky build and a swagger in his step. His ski parka was navy blue paired with gray pants and a rounded ski cap. These new details were of no help to the investigation. I also do find it hard to believe that if you saw a man in a ski cap pulling a young girl, you wouldn't stop.
I think that human brains are complicated. I like to think that I'm the type of person that would at least try to intervene, and I'd rather be wrong.
It's just so devastating to think that she probably had a moment of, I'll be okay because I'm getting to the road. I just
have
to get to the road.
Look at these 50 cars coming by. Somebody's in a stop.
Yeah, and to be in, I'll just lay my body in the road. I got away from him and I got to where help was supposed to be. And like we see so many times, there's just people aren't going to.
In her last moments, we're probably terrified. It's really horrible.
So on February 1st, 1981, only a few weeks after Barbara's death, another student was reported missing after she was absent from class. Luckily, she was located out of state very soon after. But it's just a good example of how on edge Mount Hood campus was about the safety of their students, especially the young women. Weeks, months, and years passed. By 1989, the only change in Barbara's case was that her dad, Albert Tucker, had passed away, never knowing who had been responsible for his daughter's death. 6 years later, Louise, the tenacious mother who continued to seek answers, also passed away. She had been in frequent contact with the DA and the police. She kept handwritten notes of those contacts and involved parties and every attempt to solve the case. She never gave up. And neither did the Gresham Police Department. The cold case unit continued to work on every tip they received and reviewed evidence throughout the years until this became the longest unsolved case in Gresham's history. The years rolled by until June of 2021, 41 years after Barbara's murder. After submitting DNA from the scene to Parabon Nanolabs, Gresham PD finally got a hit. It was a match to someone already on the judicial system's radar. His name was Robert Plimpton.
That is my favorite.
I know. At the time, he was an unemployed river guide, which is also questionable.
River
on the
guide.
River alone.
Mm. We've all seen River Wild.
Many times. In 1997, Troutdale resident Robert Plimpton was arrested after a woman accused him of taking her to a secluded wooded area where he attempted to rape and sodomize her. She was able to get away and press charges against him. I'm going to go ahead and assume he was not questioned in Barbara's murder, even though the circumstances were similar, which may have been due to the fact that at the time of the murder, Robert was a 16-year-old attending Reynolds High School.
I didn't know that.
Shout out alma mater. In June of 2021, with the DNA match and an arrest warrant in hand, detectives initiated a traffic stop of Robert's vehicle. Once stopped, Robert was cordial and followed their directions. Although he was underage back in 1980, it was announced that Robert would be tried as an adult for the death of Barbara Tucker. At his first hearing, he pleaded not guilty. Since then, Barbara's family had to wait to find out if he would admit any guilt, take any responsibility, show any remorse, or simply take a plea deal and quietly shuffle off to prison. Fast forward 3 years, and we have an update. Robert did not take any kind of deal. He went to trial with a judge instead of a jury. We've since learned that the June 2021 DNA match and arrest warrant came from our favorite means, gum.
I love that.
Once Robert was on detectives' radar, which may have come after the second reported assault, they started following him. They followed him until they got what they needed, his DNA. In this case, it was a piece of gum they watched him spit out.
I hope he was really enjoying that gum,
too. Oh,
just
yeah.
Like, oh, this is
chewing
like,
it.
You don't even want to spit it out yet because the flavor is
juicy.
Good.
I hope it never gets bland. I just love this for the rest of my life.
I love that they do that. And it always reminds me of that case I did where the officers couldn't wait to follow to get it. They're
yes.
like, let's go trick him.
Yes.
And they knocked on the door and they're like, we're doing market research. Do you want to try these gums?
That's so funny.
But you have to spit it out into this cup when you're done. We can't let you keep it.
So funny.
It didn't work, by the way. He was too smart.
Officers collected the gum and sent it to Parabon Labs. They sent back the results, a match from the evidence collected from Barbara's body and the gum. Once his trial began, Robert's defense was pretty impenetrable. He claimed he didn't look like the witness descriptions. You know, the things that are always proven to be so accurate.
In the dark, on the side of the road.
Uh-huh. While I'm driving and glancing over. Yeah. Judge Amy Baggio found that claim laughable and said as part of her decision, quote, to be clear, this court has zero doubt whatsoever that Robert Plimpton beat Barbara Tucker in her head and face until she died and found him guilty. Unfortunately, and in what is one of the worst legal rules that just really pisses me off.
Chaps your ass.
Robert was not convicted on sexual assault charges, even though that's how they got the DNA, because it could not be proven if any sexual assault occurred before or after she had been killed.
I'm sorry.
Which is such bullshit.
Both are assault.
She cannot give consent when she's dead.
And that is its own disgusting crime.
And also, that's why he attacked her. So that's the motive.
That's the motive.
So how is that possible? Even if she's slowly dying because he beat her head in, so she probably didn't die immediately. Ugh. And he's doing that and they can't charge
Both
it.
Both are terrible.
That stuff just, mm-mm.
But they are willing to let it go because the murder is the
right,
higher charge.
And it's you can just, get the higher charge, but it's just like, who
I want to see someone punished for everything they did.
And who cares if you can prove it?
Yeah.
If I was on the jury, I'd be like, I don't give a shit.
They
that's
really
how,
should
that's
amend
where you found
that,
the DNA.
Amend that law to include after death.
Yeah, because it's foul.
So foul.
Since his arrest, Robert's home address has been shared. This is a call out to all the Troutdale kids because maybe you know something about this guy from back in the day. And if I had to guess, if he was committing his second known sexual assault and had already murdered someone when he was just 16, I would assume, or I guess I wouldn't be surprised if they said something had happened before that.
Probably started with flashing his wiener.
Or something. So if you were in the Sandy Palisades neighborhood from late 70s through the 2020s, you may have encountered this guy. And that goes for me, too. As us deep East County kids knew back in the day, Sandy Palisades was the place to be. So Robert lived on one of the main roads in Sandy Palisades and kind of the lifeline of the neighborhood. And in that neighborhood, it's one of those ones that were built, I think, in the mid to late 70s. And it has only one entrance and exit. Now it has two because they built a little side road. But, you know, where it's like, look how safe, no one will rob you. There's only one entrance and exit. They can't get out, you know. So in that neighborhood, there are parks. There used to be a million kids around. I was there constantly because my aunt was there. My best friends lived down there. And it's basically a mile long neighborhood. And a ton of kids lived throughout it. So I'm just saying I have a little bit of a yucky feeling in my tummy that Robert Plimpton had access to a lot of kids and teenagers throughout a lot of years, especially as a river guide. That too. Who knows? Obviously, Josh and I don't want people to know where we live, but it's always upsetting to learn a horrible murderer has lived just a hop, skip, and a jump away from you for decades, especially when he's almost definitely not the only one. I'm sure we're surrounded by several. Another horrible fact is that Mount Hood Community College is less than 2 miles from his home or from where his home was. I live in an equivalent area. We would take the same roads to go to the freeway, to go to Mount. I pass Mount Hood 5 times a week. I can't go. You can't really go anywhere unless you're going on the freeway. There's nowhere to go.
All the stores.
Except passing, going up to 257th, which is where Mount Hood College is. So he was around it for decades and probably revisited and probably went walking around and who knows what else. So there, this is not an allegation. There's no proof or even conversation of him having done anything else. I just would find it hard to believe that he didn't.
There had to have been some sort of escalation.
Yeah. If you're starting at 16 with rape and murder, that's
no. I mean, it would have started with peeping or assaulting animals.
Yeah.
Showing your genitals to people.
After closing arguments in Robert's case, Jan Caro, who had been a friend of Barbara's, said, quote, she, Barbara, was funny, just a total joy to be around. To be around her, for her to pick you as a friend was an honor because that was special. You were one of the chosen ones.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah. Robert Plimpton has been found guilty of first degree murder, and we will let you know in a future update what his sentence will be. Hopefully life. I would hope and assume.
I will be annoyed if he gets parole options, but
yeah,
it
but
happens.
He is older now,
so he'll get
which
one.
Is nice. Well, yeah.
Oh, you mean because he'll die
mean,
in there?
I just mean if he gets 20, if it's 20 years before parole, he'll be like in his mid to late 80s if he's still alive.
Yeah,
so.
That's true.
That brings us to the end of our updates for this month. We do want to remind you that if you're going to be in Nashville for CrimeCon, you live there or you're going to CrimeCon, we will be there as well from May 31st to June 2nd.
Come
so be
say
sure
hi.
To come say hi. We'll have stickers, lots of Suck My Balls merch. So just that alone. And also, if you're going to be in Denver, July 12th through 14th.
Or just come to Denver.
Yeah.
If you feel like you want something to do that weekend.
Move to Denver.
Denver's beautiful that time of year.
Start a business in Denver. Raise a family in Denver. We will be at the True Crime and Paranormal Podcast Festival, July 12th through 14th. You can use code RAIN15 to get 15% off of your tickets. You can get those tickets at truecrimepodcastfestival.com. And of course, the True Crime Fest Northwest up here in Portland at the Sheraton at the airport, August 30th through September 1st. Tickets at truecrimefestnorthwest and Northwest is spelled out .com. So we've got a busy couple months.
We
and
do.
We can't wait to see and
we
meet everybody.
We want to meet you. Come say hi. Get a shirt. Get a sticker.
Bring
hang
Josh
out for a while.
That yogurt he's still waiting for.
And I bet at CrimeCon there's going to be some free coffee or really low, what was it, low price, like $1 a cup coffee.
Oh, for Derek's?
From Derek. Yeah, Crime and Coffee. Everyone said it's the best coffee there. It was better than Starbucks.
So we've got a busy summer coming your way. We hope to see you in either Nashville, Denver, or here in Portland. Have a great day, and we'll see you next Tuesday. My doctor's appointment isn't until August 27th.
Well, you'll be following the next festival. New boobs for everyone.
Yay.
Myrtle.
Oh, it's my turn.
Myrtle.
Testing, testing. Testing, testing. That's a little better. Thank you.
So while it is extremely likely he will die behind boars.
Boars? Wild boars?
Cordell.
Yeah.
Volunteering with the Distributive Education Act of America.
Club. I'm like, act? What's that?
Yeah, I have a reading disability.
I'm just reading. We know. Sorry, I'm reading along with you. That must be annoying.
It certainly is.
Honestly.
I'm going to air this for Chloe so she knows how often you lock yourself out.
It wasn't as easy as getting a copy and putting it in a magnet thing for my car because half my key was broken off in it. I had to use the half nub to unlock the door, okay?
Sorry to brag.
And that same half nub went to the other key in the ignition that was broken off, okay?
Wow.
This is me now. Bandana. I didn't know she had one of those.
Oh, yeah, she did.
Oh, iconic photo.
Was that from...
And I copied her look all the time.
Was that from
years.
Diddy? Did she? Did
oh,
you
it felt very like my boyfriend's black, so I can do
she
this.
She wore white ones mostly.
Were they like riding around on little motorcycles and stuff at the time?
You should look it up. J-Lo and
I will.
P. Diddy,
like,
red
I'm
carpet.
Just thinking of like the movie Biker Boys.
Yeah.
Let's see. Also, that picture of J-Lo and P. Diddy at the VMAs or whatever, she looks like Anne Hathaway in Havoc.
The oh, one, my God, Havoc.
Yeah, where yeah. she gets involved with the gangsters.
Yeah.
I haven't
just
seen
say,
it.
Oh, my God.
But
gosh.
Now I got to watch
There's
it.
There's literally a line they cut back to her, and she's sitting, like, on a... just
like a stoop.
Yeah, a stoop or something. And they cut back to her, like, we're just cutting in on this conversation. She's like, you know, just hanging out, being cool, being a cool teenager. Hey, do you guys listen to hip-hop? My mom, years ago... We took a family trip, probably for a week or a couple, maybe to Vegas. And we came home and she, to this day, it's probably been 25 years at least, to this day, if you mention it, is sick to her stomach, as we all are, because she forgot to tell the house sitter about my brother's hamster.
Oh, yeah. Oof. That's yikes.
And she went, oh, my God, we didn't tell her.
And it died.
And it died. And to this day, my mom cannot. Go there, which I get. Well, you know, everyone has had little mistakes like kind of like that. And
like when I accidentally fed the fish yeah. food that was by the ant trap and yeah. it poisoned it and died.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. At least it went quick.
Yeah.
It's roasted in a brick building on the Hudson River.
Stop it. Are you serious?
Artisanal. Yes. It was the greatest. It was cheap. Oh, it was beautiful. Denver's a clean town. It was nice.
It's beautiful. And I highly recommend getting compression socks for that flight if you're Denver regular visitor, because the elevation will
I'm
get
gonna
you.
I'm going to be winded in Denver, guys. Don't ask me to talk for too long. Not you guys. People that I have to meet.
Yeah.
That I cannot wait to meet. I'm afraid to meet you, but it's going to be
Make
wonderful.
Sure you bring your gummy bears.
Oh,
that's right.
I'm going to be, yeah, that's probably what I'll do is just get real smooth.
Yeah. You'll be good.
Yeah. I'll probably sit down even more than last time.
Oh, good.
My legs feet.
We don't need bare feet in an exhibition hall.
Well, no. Here's what I'll do. I'm going to get a cardboard box that goes like up to my knee. And I can just put my foot in there and take the shoe
you
off.
Flipped it when somebody pays
I'll
you
have
yogurt.
Like I'll have like a flashlight. I'll shine on it.
Yo.
And
why is that
it'll
why
be...
you think people want to pay yogurt for? What if they want to give you a little smooch or get a sticker?
You want to slob my knob?
Oh!
They can slob my feet knobs.
Ew!
Assault,
assault.
I'm sorry.
Murder in the Rain is a Cascade Media production, written, hosted, and edited by Josh McCullough, Emily Rowney, and Alicia Holland. Feel free to email us at murderintherain@gmail.com or through our website, murderintherain.com. For as little as $1 a month, you can subscribe on Patreon to get exclusive access to ad-free and older episodes. For only $5, you can access Patreon-exclusive episodes and content. For more of us, be sure to follow on all the socials, listen to Josh and Alicia on their other show, Always Be My Sisters, and follow Emily on TikTok at @M_murderintherain.
And suck my balls.